All right, welcome everyone to our March session of the Football Scholars Forum. I'm very happy that we can have so many people join us and that we can discuss the research of Chris Brown, a longtime Football Scholars Forum member, somebody that we've shared conferences and pickup games with, and a good friend. So excited to chat about his paper that we all read, entitled Envisioning the City Through Soccer in the Brazilian Amazon, 1914 to 2014. Work on progress and kind of an overview of some of the things that Chris will be telling us about in his wider dissertation. So with that, I'll leave it to Chris to tell us a little bit about this paper and its place in his work.
Great. Thanks very much, Alex. And hello, everyone from Atlanta, Georgia. And thank you so much for taking the time to join this session. My dissertation in general focuses on the history of Manaus, the capital of Amazonas state in Brazil. And as we all know, it was one of the host cities of the 2014 World Cup. And more broadly, I'm interested in how Manaus's location, its physical and symbolic location in Brazil, in the heart of the Amazon basin, has impacted ideas about the city in Manaus, and what implications those ideas may have had. And I'm interested in how those localized ideas interact with national and international models. And I suspected that soccer would be a good way to go about looking at this. And by soccer, I was thinking broadly about stadiums, the soccer calendar and clubs, and commentary surrounding soccer as a useful context for exploring these ideas. So in this paper, I try to lay out two key foundational moments, not only for the city of Manaus, the modern city of Manaus, but also for soccer history in the city. The first being the late 19th and early 20th century rubber boom and then bust in Manaus, which grew the city and within which the emergence of early organized clubs and soccer championships took place. The second period is the consolidation of the free trade zone and eventual industrial pole in Manaus, which was put into place in the late 1960s and 1970s, and which very much stimulated the urban economy of Manaus by putting this special economic zone right on it, on the city's doorstep. During that period, and as you'd have seen in the paper, in 1970, Manaus's stadium that preceded the World Cup stadium was semi-completed in 1970, and the Brazilian national team played there for the first time. And my argument is that these two foundational moments are both important points in the history of the city and soccer in the city, but also that they very much play an important role in the localized memory of soccer in Manaus today that went some way to explaining some of the things that happened during the Soccer World Cup in 2014. One prominent example that was very much a question of public debate in the build-up to the tournament was the spat between the England head coach, Roy Hodgson, and the mayor of Manaus and various other politicians and media commentators after Hodgson declared that Manaus was the city that he would prefer to avoid in the World Cup draw. Of course, eventually England were drawn to play in Manaus and the row was diffused through various means, but one of them was by the presentation to the England team of a newspaper cutting that was featuring the English team, or British team, that had won the first codified Amazonas soccer championship in 1914. That team, Manaus Athletic, became more widely known, not only in Manaus, but in England, as a result of this contemporary incident. And so my project aims to look at all the ideas about the Amazon that drive things that happen and what people think about things that happen in Manaus. And I'm hoping soccer is going to be a useful way of doing that. I am early in the writing stage, and I'm really so grateful that you've taken the time to join today. And so I'll leave it there and open it up to comments and questions.
Great. I'll start us off with a question so that way we can have a moment to fill the queue and everyone can start raising their hands and lining up to ask Chris about the paper. And we also had some people send in questions who were unable to join, so I'll do my best to find some space, maybe in the middle or towards the end, to pose their questions to Chris. But mine's pretty simple, Chris. You talk about three especially of the club teams in Manaus, and they come up at different points in the paper. Could you tell us a little bit about the sources and how you were able to tell the story that you told about them, and maybe just a little bit of explanation of what the club world is like in Manaus that contextualizes something that you mentioned in your paper, that professionalization comes in the 1960s, which for others of us who have looked at club soccer elsewhere is fairly late, but there's plenty of reasons to contextualize it.
Great, thanks, Alex. Yes, so the three clubs that I mentioned in the paper are Rio Negro, São Raimundo, and Nacional. And Rio Negro and Nacional were both founded in 1913, following similar patterns that we see elsewhere in Latin America and beyond. And the records of their foundation are to be found in local press reports and also in a burgeoning sporting press. Periodicals that would occasionally come out with 4 to 6 pages, and they would cover what was going on at these nascent clubs. And thirdly, another source that I'm still exploring but is proving useful are the records of Rio Negro Club in particular. The president of the club has let me and researchers from the Federal University of Amazonas photograph some of the atas, so the minutes and other reports from the club. And these are not complete, but they are handwritten documents from the 1910s that give, you know, plenty of insights into what was going on. So focusing on Rio Negro, it was founded by, you know, the typical cabal of young men who were keen on founding not only a social club, but particularly focusing on soccer at that point. But most of the individuals involved had previously been involved with other nascent organizations in the city or associations in the city. That included rowing, cycling, and other endeavors. But it's in 1913 and then in 1914 when the formal introduction of the Amazonas State Championship, which is of course based entirely in Manaus and has, I think, 5 or 6 teams participating, that's when that takes place. And what we see at this time is an increasing prominence of reporting on soccer matches, not only in the specific sporting or club-based pamphlets, periodicals, but also in the more mainstream papers. São Raimundo is founded slightly later in 1918 in the neighborhood of the same name, and it's an interesting sort of third party to this triumvirate, because it remains very much based, its members and its support base are in this neighborhood. Whereas Rio Negro and Nacional, they move around slightly and they provide pretty wealthy spaces of club association. So the Rio Negro Club eventually builds a new social seat in 1941 that is still used today, and it's right in the center of the city. Nacional similarly has a social seats that includes swimming pool, etc. And that's in a fairly affluent neighbourhood today, Adrianopolis. And so Rio Negro and Nacional are the two major players in terms of stature throughout the subsequent century in Manaus, with fluctuations, of course. But they are the two who are venerated today as the founders of the soccer culture of the city, or at least the club-based soccer culture.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Let's start our questions with Brenda.
Thanks, Alex. I really enjoyed your chapter, Chris. I've been looking forward to reading it for a long time, and it's striking how much of Latin American history is still focused on the capital cities, mine included. I'm as guilty as anybody. So it's really great to see work coming out of Manaus, really, really not enough historiography. So my question is, you point out a few different really interesting controversies, right? Both about reconciling modernity in Manaus in the early part of the 20th century, then the free trade bloc, and then the World Cup. So you kind of have like three interesting political, and I might have missed others, but three interesting political moments. I was wondering if you found the football clubs themselves embroiled in these in any significant way.
Thanks very much, Brenda. Yes. Well, so if I take each period as it comes, the first one, the early 20th century, so just at the moment that these clubs that it turns out continue, just as they are founded, that's precisely when the economy of the Amazon region is collapsing. And it can't be underestimated how much the collapse of the rubber industry impacted Manaus, which was very much a entrepot of exports of rubber. So one of the interesting sources is a magazine produced by Rio Negro Club from 1913, periodically until the late 1920s. And what's remarkable about this is really a continuation of the types of articles and commentary that was also prominent from its founding right through the 1920s. And in some ways, it seems that the imploding political and economic situation around the club was kept to some degree out of the pages of this magazine. But more broadly, many of the officials involved with these wealthy clubs, relatively wealthy in the local context, were also involved in politics. And this won't be a surprise to us as we see cases from elsewhere. And so when political changes are made, it does sometimes directly impact the individuals and to some degree the fortunes of the clubs. One of the presidents of Rio Negro was imprisoned in the 1930s, considered to be in opposition to then President Vargas, for instance. In the case of the second period I focus on in the paper, the free trade zone and Zona Franca, something that has occurred to me when reading the sources is that many of the ideas that drive projects in Manaus' soccer culture transcend regime change. So one reason for the slightly confusing chronology in the paper, perhaps at times, is that the idea for creating a special economic zone in Manaus was first lifted up in the Congress, National Congress, in 1957. And it was only in 1967, so 3 years after the military coup in 1964, that this idea was put into practice. And similarly, the state government based in Manaus, which aimed to create a large-scale stadium in the city, laid the foundation stone and made noise about this in 1958. And it was not until the late 1960s that this idea was actually put into practice. So while the soccer clubs are operating within this broader context always, one of the things I'm still trying to work out is the extent to which they mirror the broader political and economic changes, or when in some cases those, for instance, regime change or change of state governor, if they are not the decisive factors in changing policy decisions taken within the soccer organizations.
Thanks, Chris.
Let's move on to Daniel.
Yeah, hi, Chris. This is Daniel. I have a question. You refer a lot to the fact that Manaus was host city at the World Cup. It will be also a host city of the Olympic soccer tournament. And I think there were 12 host cities at the World Cup. Now there are just 6 host cities. Manaus is one of them. I remember a lot of critical articles, statements by FIFA, where they said they would not accept that Manaus would be nominated by the organizing committee. But at the end, the organizing committee succeeded. So could you elaborate, why is it important for the organizing committee to include Manaus? Why was it selected as just 1 out of 6 cities? Why did they want by all means to make Manaus an Olympic city?
Thank you very much, Daniel. Yes, the question of the selection of Manaus, both the Olympics and the World Cup, is one that I don't have any secret documents to bring to the table at this stage. But you're right to say that FIFA itself was reluctant to include Manaus as a host city of the Olympics. And it was, you're right, pressure from the local organizing committee and presumably government that was keen on including Manaus. And in the case of the World Cup, Manaus was competing with 2 other Amazonian cities, Belém, which is the large rival on the Atlantic coast, and a much smaller city, Rio Branco, in Acre, which is far to the west of Manaus on Brazil's border. And Manaus was chosen. And in addition to perhaps existing political connections, the governor of Amazonas at the time of the choosing of Manaus by FIFA as a host city for the World Cup, the governor of Amazonas was a close ally of Lula, then president. And there were other factors. For instance, Manaus was willing to completely to demolish its existing large stadium, the Vivaldão, and replace it with a completely new stadium, whereas some of the other bidding cities were aiming to remodel existing stadia, perhaps seen as a less perfect way of proceeding. So in addition to those political and logistical questions that may have given Manaus a better position in the campaign, I think the idea of having a Amazonian city host, particularly one that is so obviously Amazonian, given its location and history, such as Manaus, I think that plays an important part in, or at least some part, in how these decisions are made. I know there's only so much we can take from quotes from politicians or people involved in such things, but frequently they'll refer to the fact that the Amazon contains 60% of Brazil's territory and it should be represented somehow in the Olympics. So my hunch is that it's those 3 factors contributing to the eventual acceptance by FIFA of the local organizing committee's recommendation to include Manaus. Political factors, the power of state governors, for instance, also the logistical willingness of Manaus to go the extra mile to accommodate mega event demands. And thirdly, the great advantage that Manaus has, and which was reflected in its selection as a location for a free trade zone in the late 1960s, which was the imperative over successive Brazilian governments and regimes to develop the Amazonian basin interior. And one of those ways of developing it would be through creating and sustaining and enlarging the city of Manaus.
Great, thanks, Chris. Let's move on to Georgios.
Hey there, Chris. First off, great stuff, as always. There's obviously lots here to discuss, but what I found particularly interesting is that you have this city that builds physical spaces so that it can, in theory, showcase itself. You mentioned at the regional, national, international levels. But there's this interesting point on who is actually occupying those spaces. And I think you do well to show that it's not simply, the local ads. That by, I think, the mid-20th century, local sides are importing players from other parts of Brazil. And then later on, of course, you see entire teams coming in to take part in contests among themselves. So did you get a sense of how this went over or played out among some of the local citizens?
Great. Thanks, George, and great to hear from you. That's a great question. And one of the key public debates in Manaus' sporting press in the 60s in particular is precisely the question of Manaus' clubs becoming slightly more powerful economically, managing slightly more regular high attendances in the existing stadia in the city. So we're talking maybe 12,000 for derby matches. And so in the 60s in particular, players start to be imported not just from Belém or certain parts of the Brazilian Northeast, where on an ad hoc basis they may have come from before, but you have agents in Rio, Belo Horizonte, and São Paulo contracting large numbers of players. In some cases, for instance, contracting the entire reserve team of a Minas Gerais-based club and bringing them to Manaus. And yes, the discussions we would expect in the local press were torn between, on the one hand, recognizing this was a symbol of Manaus' rising clout in the nation, in soccer terms, not rising too much, it should be added, but also there were concerns about what this would have, the impact this would have on the trail of Amazonense talent. But a key part of this that we should always remember is Manaus, ever more throughout the 20th century, is a city of migrants. And particularly during the after the rubber boom collapsed in the 1910s, 1920s, then again after the Second World War, and then again moving into the establishment and consolidation of the free trade zone, large percentages of Manaus's growing neighborhoods are coming from the Brazilian Northeast or from the interior of Amazonas. So this creates a very much a urban identity in flux in terms of questions of belonging. And so one aspect of bringing in players from elsewhere was precisely to tap into that sense of wanting Manaus to be a showcase for the nation as a whole, or at least in particular from the Northeast. So there was discussion about the utility, the significance of bringing in players, bringing teams to play. And just on an aside, talking about more recent developments, the World Cup Stadium last year, so in 2015, hosted a tournament, mini tournament, a sort of off-season tournament between three southeastern-based teams, tapping into the huge numbers of supporters in Manaus of teams from Rio or São Paulo, particularly Flamengo, which holds sway in Manaus as it does elsewhere in Brazil outside Rio. And the stadium attracted large attendances for most of these games. And yet, at the same time, the people involved in Manaus's clubs were understandably concerned that this tournament didn't include any teams from Manaus, so the question of sustainability came up. So I think this is a running theme that you've identified for sure, and it should be considered within the space of migration as well into the city.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, continuing on, Tarminder.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for the paper. I learned a lot purely because I've not been reading much about Brazilian soccer at all. So it was very interesting. I have two questions. One, relating to, is your work purely archival, or do you do any oral history? So it's more broader than the paper, oral history or other forms of data collection. And the second is related to the point you mentioned, and this is purely my own research interest, that's why kind of just if you can comment something more on it. You talk about on page 13 about development in Amazon and like how sports, the idea of developing sports infrastructure or sport in general, linked to nation building and localized identification of belonging. But obviously, you're not arguing this is what happens. But what sort of information is kind of there? What does province or what does the what are they doing or what kind of projects are emerging in the name of development and maybe you can share something more about this whole idea around soccer development and how it kind of plays into justification for soccer, hosting soccer tournaments. I mean, that was a big thing in South African World Cup as well. Like, it was developing something in South Africa. That's it for me.
Thanks very much, Tarminder. I appreciate those questions. So first on the research I'm doing, it is largely archival, including the kinds of documents I've mentioned, press, club documents. Also, I've tried to pay attention to things like team uniforms or other remnants of material culture from matches. These largely held in private archives. I've been very lucky to work with historians based in Manaus who are also interested in building up private archives of former team jerseys or match tickets, that kind of thing. So that's very much a work in progress. As for oral histories and interviews, in my initial phase, I conducted interviews with administrators and people involved with the clubs. That's where I focused to begin with. And I intend going back at some point in the next year to expand that. And so I think a formal oral history project would be very much of use here. And and luckily, one of the clubs, Nacional, has, in celebrating its centenary, been doing a kind of series of interviewing ex-players and ex-participants. So one of the things I'm hoping to do is benefit from, and then hopefully for my own purposes, see if I can build on those structures that are in place. So I think if my dissertation is to go down the route of bringing us up to date, then I'd like very much to expand the scope of that element.
Okay.
To your second question on developments, one of the interesting ways I came to this project was I was interested originally in the Amazon as a region in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And the efforts made from the major cities, particularly Belém and Manaus, to connect with rural communities, for instance, through educational measures. And one of the early documents I came across, just by chance, was a set of petitions in Belém, which were asking the state government and municipal government there to provide funding for sports associations and clubs to go into the so-called interior and provide a combination of sporting and educational uplift of some kind. And that's from the early 20th century. That was interesting to me. Mm-hmm. Thinking about the period of the military regime in Brazil, so from 64 to 85, there was a huge increase of all kinds of educational, health-based initiatives in the Amazon region in particular, for instance, radio projects designed to reach communities. And so there's a broader context going on in the region of huge federal investment in development projects. And so, yes, I was hoping to piggyback on those, thinking about how the expansion of radio and eventually television was in turn bringing the clubs of Rio and other soccer culture based in the national heartlands of the southeast to the households in Manaus, or people who are accessing these programs. So that's something I'm definitely interested in looking more at. And just finally, and that, something we haven't mentioned, it's not in the paper, is the amateur tournament based in Manaus called the Peladão, or the Big Kickabout. And this is that Alex Belos, in his book, The Brazilian Way of Life, dedicated a chapter to. And it has been running since 1973 in various formats, but increasingly it is positioning itself and its administrator in getting funding from various sources and following through on it, is positioning itself as a force for particularly health and education propagation in Manaus's and nearby communities. And this is something that's only increased as the Peladão has become a sort of counterpoint to the professional side of soccer in Manaus, or the existing clubs. The Peladão is seen as a outlet for neighborhood-based participation in soccer, whereas the clubs, and decreasingly successfully, are, you know, aiming to transcend neighborhoods in many cases. So thank you, I appreciate them. And I think on all points there's more can be done, sure.
Oh, well, this is fascinating. Thank you. I look forward to reading more of your work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next up is Matt Hawkins.
Hi, Chris. I'm really, really excited to read about Manaus. It's a city that's always captured my imagination in terms of a place for football after seeing it in the World Cup, and just thinking about northern Brazilian cities and the struggles that their clubs go through to sort of compete against the southern clubs in terms of their fan bases. One of the things that I would like to hear more about is sort of the growth and maybe the decline of the local clubs in terms of their own fan bases. I just looked up a couple of videos of the fans now and of the Manaus teams, and the stadiums look a little empty, but the one people that are going seem to be really, really passionate about their clubs. And I was wondering if you can see those types of things in the historical record, and if the people who follow these clubs are coming out in the newspapers and in the club documents.
Thanks, Matt. I appreciate that. So, there's lots of interesting things here. One is that until 1970, the clubs, when playing major games between each other, would play in the Parque Amazonense, which had been first converted into a soccer venue in 1918. And this held differing levels of attendance. But we're not talking in general more than 12,000. And so one of the sets of images that does the rounds in Manaus are images of these, of this packed stadium for local derby matches. Now, the Vivaldal, which has a capacity somewhere around 43,000, is brought into play in 1970. And yes, it does manage to fill for certain local derby matches throughout the 70s. And then with the occasional visit of, as we saw, the Brazil team or the Cosmos in 1980, or other exhibition matches, Pelé and Garrincha both played there. Garrincha, that he was at the Parque Amazonense. But this stadium does manage to fill for local matches or games against teams coming from the national championship. However, in terms of the numbers, it's difficult to corroborate the sense that the 1970s truly was an unambiguous golden era of fan attendance in Manaus. It certainly seems that there was more fan participation in clubs and around clubs. Media attention was greater than it is today. But I think I try to remember that the state championship in Manaus or Amazonas rarely encompassed more than, let's say, a dozen games during these periods, depending on, you know, shifting formats. So I am currently still weighing this idea of a golden age in Manaus' soccer coinciding with the stadium, although that's certainly how it's remembered in dominant narratives. And in terms of why there was a decline in interest in local club soccer, and that's certainly the case, well, I think while in the 1960s and 70s, large stadiums are built across Brazil and in places like Manaus, that's also in the 70s when television is starting to spread, and therefore the reach of the Rio and Sao Paulo-based clubs already popularized through the radio is becoming ever greater. And studies of working habits and leisure habits in the Manaus, among workers in the Manaus Free Trade Zone in the 70s and 80s, are showing decreasing space for participation in clubs or activities beyond localized neighborhoods. Just one practical reason for this is that as Manaus expands, balloons in the 1970s, the neighborhoods in which people working in the Zona Franca, the free trade zone, are based, are getting further and further away, in some cases, from the actual zone of work. So it's a national trend toward that accelerates in subsequent decades toward people tending towards having closer affiliation to Rio or Sao Paulo-based clubs. And also, if you look at the games today, when Flamengo or Corinthians or Botafogo go to Manaus, they're more likely to garner a large turnout at the stadium than the local clubs. And I know that's something we've seen in all the press coverage around the World Cup. Was there another part to your question, Matt, that or did you want to follow up?
Well, it's just sort of, as you're talking, I was thinking about those three different teams and sort of a simple question, but do they represent neighborhoods or do they represent different aspects of Manaus as a city?
Sure, yeah. São Raimundo represents its neighborhood, but there are other clubs that participate in the state championship in that neighborhood. Rio Negro was, if we think about the broader Latin American context of having a two-team model in cities, Rio Negro is the team of the elites, at least nominally. In practice, membership of the club is similar at Rio Negro to how it would be at Nacional, the other team. Nacional founded in 1913, was originally called 11 Nacional, and it changed to 11 Nacional, or in Portuguese. And Nacional was set up very much as an explicit response to the participation of British and Portuguese teams back in 1914. So, yes, the clubs today, São Raimundo is, like other neighbourhood clubs, associated with a neighbourhood. Rio Negro is in something of a liminal zone. Its social seat is in the centre of the city, and its soccer club is not but as strong as it. Soccer section is not as strong as it was before. Nacional is the team that has the greatest chance of all the teams of making an impact on a sustained basis in the national championship. They have a modest training centre, they have a social club and seat, and they have the largest support base among local teams in the city.
Great. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, almost half time here. I'm going to read a question from email, and then Jennifer, and then Peter. So this question was emailed by Kevin Talik Marston. He says to Chris, "It's encouraging to see how the work has progressed since your 2014 Avalanche scholarship, and I look forward to reading the final dissertation and your book. The whole paper was interesting, but Kevin especially enjoyed reading the first section on the rubber boom period prior to 1914, which, if he recalls correctly, was not previously such a strong focus. He'd be curious if any parallels you've discovered in other city historiographies. Here I think of Alex's ongoing work in Buenos Aires or Brenda's, as Manaus is in some ways so unique due to its geographic isolation. And yet the city was also just another post-industrial boomtown, which mushroomed with the same type of development processes so common to many cities connected to global trade patterns during the late 19th century. So Kevin would wonder, how does Manaus compare? What is its uniqueness, or is there really one? He also was intrigued to know more about the perceived incongruence that you mention on page 5 within the urban natural opposition, the domestic internal international connections. What are the contradictions in the history of Manaus that we see through the lens of sport? So throwing a lot at you, but I wanted to read his whole email for you.
Thanks very much, Alex. Yeah, I appreciate that. So first, thinking about, yeah, what is unique or similar about Manaus in the rubber boom, the early 20th century, as compared to other cities, such as Buenos Aires or other Latin American cities? Well, this is, Josh Nadel would sympathize with, something that's very much an ongoing project. In the city itself, there is a hive of activity to discover the origin moment of soccer, of modern organized soccer in the city. When was that first game? When was the first club really played? And one of my colleagues there, Gaspar Vieira Neto, he has been doing a lot of work in the archives to keep pushing back the moment when we think the first reported on game was played. And I think 1903 is the current point. In some ways, what happens within the realms of these emerging clubs is pointedly similar to what's going on elsewhere. And the reason for that is in the sports periodicals that they produce, the writers are either ciphering articles they've read from Rio's press, for instance, or they are speaking very directly to that milieu that they imagined was swirling throughout the Atlantic world of soccer clubs and other sporting activities. And yet, the fact that Manaus is... So Jeffrey Nidell wrote a book called A Tropical Belle Epoque, which was about early 20th century Rio de Janeiro. And it's, among other things, its clubs and its elites and how they were forming culture and all the trends that we're familiar with. Well, in the case of Manaus, the writers and sports people involved in these clubs were trying to address also the knowledge that if heel was considered to be tropical, then they were even more quintessentially so. And one of the interesting things that changes is in the early 20th century, the message coming from these writers, sports writers, sort of budding writers of sporting modernity, is that they are separate from the rainforests and the people that surround them. So swimming should be highly regulated, in particular, lest outsiders consider this to be a remnant of backward interior Amazonian practices. There was concern that the city should be recognized elsewhere for its organization of clubs and eventually the league. And so Manaus is very much, because it is this international place during the rubber boom, it's very much producing a conscious effort to precisely connect with things that are going on elsewhere. Now, thinking about that incongruence that was mentioned, I think one of the most interesting things about studying soccer in Manaus is the question of rubber and indigenous people. The presence of rubber in the Amazon basin, the rubber tree that was most profitable and most useful in the rubber boom, was something that would eventually tie in with the question of soccer history and soccer memory in Manaus. So a recent documentary made about the history of soccer in Amazonas featured the famous Amazonense writer and playwright Marcio Souza, and he was emphasizing that Manaus too was one of the sort of pre-modern fonts of what we now know as organized modern soccer, precisely because indigenous people played with rubber or balls taken from latex, and that there's a direct link to be made between travelers' accounts of the Amazon seeing ball games and what would eventually become the industrial modern soccer. And so he traces a story of it then coming full circle with the return of the modern international game to Manaus. So I think one of the things I find in many of the sources I look at when they're coming from a more elite perspective is an attempt to shield or incubate the city they're operating in from the Amazonian hinterland around them. Well, what's changed now with various impulses of marketing but also environmentalism or changing ideas about the Amazon as a whole is that now the rainforest can be more safely included in the narrative of soccer without being excluded from it. And that not only it's not only something that doesn't bring damage to the modern story of soccer in Manaus, but in fact it enhances it. So I think what I'm saying to try and tie these three things together is the people writing about soccer in Manaus, when they're looking to show that what's going on in Manaus is really very similar, if not the same as what's going on elsewhere, in Buenos Aires, elsewhere, the tools they use to achieve this changes in an interesting way.
Am I up?
Great.
Great. Thank you so much, Chris. I have a question that relates to the idea of permanence and connectivity that you sort of introduced in the beginning and then pull through the paper. And that's related to the destruction of the two previous stadiums. So I'm wondering what kind of sense of loss accompanied this process of modernization. So what kind of stadium culture was lost? What kind of sort of community culture was lost? And how does that relate to the notion of permanence that you're working with? And then similarly, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about the sort of effacement of rowing and cycling with the growth of modern soccer. So what was more modern about soccer, and what did the sort of loss of rowing and cycling cultures imply?
Great. Thanks, Jennifer. So first on the question of loss, and tying into the previous comment, again, one of the things that was trying to be done in the early 20th century in Manaus was precisely to build an entirely new urban centre. So building the theatre, building the imagined requirements of urban modernity, filling in the streams that would otherwise run more readily throughout the modern city. That was an effort at building something new. And then when it comes to losing aspects of that sort of Belle Epoque period, the Parque Amazonense ends in 73, and then the Vivaldo Lima Stadium, which was built in 1970, when it's demolished just before the World Cup, yes, it inspires this debate and tension between, is Manaus defined, or should it be defined by the rubber boom? Should that be the starting point for thinking about modern Manaus? And how has the Parque Amazonense in Vivaldão itself, more associated with the free trade zone, but how do they represent those periods in Manaus history, and what are the consequences of getting rid of them? Well, there was political and media pushback against the demolition of the Vivaldão, but ultimately the state government decision was to do that. The SOP that was provided was to add Vivaldo Lima to the name of the new Arena da Amazônia. And the Parque Amazonense remains there today, but all that really remains is the facade with a horse head on the front, so a remnant of the rubber boom. So the question of loss is one that's tied up with what exactly is the legacy of the rubber boom. Now, historians in recent decades have, of course, completely switched their focus on the rubber boom, focused on how it was experienced by most people and not simply the people populating the theatre or Rio Negro Club. And yet there is a huge pull of the rubber boom as a foundational moment in city projects. So one example, slightly outside the realm of soccer, is a new urban park development was completed in the 2000s, quite central to the city. And in order to complete that, tens of thousands of people were moved from a favela or shantytown area alongside one of the streams in central Manaus. And this development created a urban leisure space which was themed around the rubber boom. So it has winding paths and statues representing the elite figures of the rubber boom, or the tramway of the British-owned company. And the tourist brochures and plaques at the site very much contrast the disorder and squalor of the previous shantytown with the order and splendor of the rubber boom. And then coming on to your second point about how is it that soccer became preeminent in Manaus, and I think the pattern probably follows broader patterns. And one thing about rowing is interesting, that there was a strong German presence in Manaus at least until the First World War, and the rowing club that has been recorded at least was Germanic. And I think in addition to being a slightly less accessible sport under certain conditions, I think perhaps its association with the Germans, who were then subject to some hostility in the Amazon region during the First World War, think that has some reason for the rise of soccer there. And cycling, for similar reasons to rowing, Manaus actually had a sort of velodrome type structure until 1909, and then it was demolished by the state government in favour of a residential project. So I have a lot more work to do to look into the details of how certain urban spaces are, you know, why they ended up how they did. But it certainly tied into the connections that develop between politicians who see the rise of these clubs as a way of having some impact within the clubs and more broadly by affiliation.
Great. We have a question from Peter here in East Lansing.
Yeah, thanks, Chris, for a really great paper. I always enjoy reading these kinds of studies as someone who, you know, doesn't generally read a lot of Latin American history or Brazilian history, and really are to be commended in the way that you were linking sport to society in such an insightful way. And, you know, I saw a lot of parallels with South Africa, as Tarminder also noted earlier, particularly in the realm of stadiums and white elephants, which I think Manaus is one of the ones that's most likely to become one. But my question, rather than going to the comparative right away, has to do with, you know, these elites mainly who are shaping this vision of the Amazonian city and this kind of what you call Amazonian urbanity, these visions of modernity. And again, from as an outsider, I was wondering if you could say more about the role of race, ethnicity, class, and masculinity, and how it informs the perspectives of these cultural brokers, the politicians that you say, the bureaucrats, the military officers, which we don't hear much about, but certainly journalists, intellectuals, community organizers. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, so I think connecting ethnicity to Manaus can be done by focusing on the constituencies of the idea and social designation of the caboclo, which is to refer to primarily mixed race inhabitants of the Amazon region, in this case, largely associated with white and indigenous so-called mixture. And in addition to that fundamental basis of ethnicity in the Amazon, you then have this huge influx of Northeasterners from the Brazilian Northeast migrations into the Amazon during subsequent waves. And I think that when the people writing about Manaus as a modern place are doing so, they're doing so often by negating or downplaying the significance of the caboclo as a influential ethnic actor in Manaus. Really, what it's an attempt to sanitize the term caboclo by using it to describe, for instance, early 20th century, so these people involved in these clubs in 1913, 14, for instance, to use the term caboclo to describe the participants in games against British teams. Now, those participants would most likely be from the middle to upper levels of society and therefore not consider themselves caboclo outside the space of a sort of an insincere designation. So I think throughout Manaus' 20th century history, you have changing uses and understandings of the term caboclo, and I think that's the most important thing. And in terms of race, they're actually, and indeed ethnicity, I have a lot more to do to investigate this in the context of Manaus' soccer culture. And one reason for this is that my initial reading of the sources is finding more references to region. And I think this probably is a reflection of my own push towards that area. And so I would have to say that there's simply a lot more to be done on that front. But in the meantime, this question of migration in Manaus is crucial because at key points in Manaus' history, the governors and the military officials, and certainly during the military period, they're coming from other regions of Brazil. And one way of looking at what's going on in the Amazon during this period is a internal development or slightly less fashionable internal colonization efforts to impose upon and shape the existing mixed population in the region to connect them more thoroughly with national centers, as would be the point of view of the military bureaucrats planning those educational programs I was talking about. So I appreciate the question, Peter, and I'm not sure I have a full answer at this stage. As for class and masculinity, certainly by looking at soccer clubs and what kind of catchment areas they appeal to, and also by returning to that comparison between the professional and the amateur, here we can see very clearly divisions that are exacerbated with the creation of the free trade zone in the late 1960s, as you have a huge expansion of neighborhoods that are far, far from the city center and quite far from the free trade zone and industrial pole, that they become places where clubs are set up, amateur clubs. And you can see, I can see in their constitutions, for instance, yes, affirmations of working identities. So as I explore this more, I'll be thinking more of Brenda's work in Chile and the way clubs were providing a place not only for association, but also for some kind of formation of collective identities or political identities.
And those themselves are shaped by particular expressions of masculinity as well, no? The kind of solidarities, I would assume, or not. I'm curious about that. Because, I mean, this modernity that's being articulated seems to be deeply gendered.
Yes, absolutely. And it is deeply gendered. And we can see from the early 20th century magazines, etc., that the role of women in the clubs, they occasionally have space in the magazines for writing pieces, poetry, etc. But, yeah, certainly the question of climate and what's going on in Manaus and whether this can be considered modern, yes, you're right, is absolutely tied up with masculinity. And it's one of the reasons for leading with the Teddy Roosevelt visit example, that you know the youthful, hopeful soccer players who hoped to welcome Roosevelt with a soccer match, yes, they were precisely putting their request in the terms of successful masculine endeavor in the face of great odds. Yes, so I mean actually, at another time, I'd considered that masculinity was the main thrust of the project. And so I think, yes, I'll certainly think about front-loading
and that obviously a bit more. It's changing. I mean, you've got this kind of elite masculinity at the outset during the rubber boom. I would imagine the Caboclo masculinity is different. And also the ones you mentioned are the working class clubs arising in the expanding city also have different kinds of masculinity, sometimes within the same club. So that was something really interesting. But thank you for the answer.
I have another question, but since it's a nice segue, I'll read another one of Kevin's questions because it has to do with Roosevelt's visit. Kevin asks, I'd also love to know more about the international soccer match during Roosevelt's visit. Roosevelt was a fervent collegiate football man, as he recalls, and he was curious about whether any connections had been made with the early leadership of the American Football Association, or the USFA. Were they included in a delegation? I presume not, but who knows? He's currently doing some research on some of the early U.S. administrators and would be curious to know what connections they had diplomatically, if any, by being included in corresponding or planning of such international soccer matches. Did the match take place in the end? Did Roosevelt attend? That's his question.
Great. Thanks, Alex. Yes, no, that's a great question. And the match did not take place, and it's a reflection of the still tenuous hold of soccer on the cultural purse strings of Manaus at the time. In 1914, the planned match for Roosevelt was not included in the program. And anyway, Roosevelt arrived in Manaus extremely ill from his previous exploits. And so the whole visit was something of a damp squib. And to the question of contact with early US administrators, no, I haven't seen anything suggesting that. And you're right, or the comment is of course right, that yeah, Roosevelt being welcomed with a soccer match would perhaps seem slightly incongruous. But I remember a conference paper at the Nash conference last year discussing football in Mexico, I believe, on similar themes. But one thing that's interesting that I haven't had a chance to look at yet, that George actually kindly provided me, was the US Soccer Administration records from 1950, the 1950 World Cup in Brazil. There were efforts made in Manaus to bring the US team to Manaus to play an exhibition match after the US had been eliminated. And I'm interested in looking more at the machinations involved with that. And more broadly, in terms of administration and connections between the brokers in Manaus and elsewhere, as you get to the 60s, 70s, 80s, that's when Manaus's soccer reach is gaining hold, and they are able to contract players from elsewhere, contract club teams to come and play on a more regular basis. And this is part of a broader sporting effort in the Amazonas state, which by the 80s has got up and running a slightly more sustained athletic program in general. And I think one of the impulses behind this is precisely to include Manaus and Amazonas as a viable destination and participant in national and international sporting activities. So the current World Cup stadium, which is on the site of the Vivaldão from 1970, right next to it is the huge Samba Dome. But just beyond there, there's the Olympic Training Center in Manaus, or so-called Olympic Training Center. And so the stadium complex also has an indoor stadium next door. And so it's part of a broader strategy. So it wouldn't be, you know, it's perhaps common to describe the stadium as very much on its own. Well, now it's part of a broader sporting complex, which is used to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the facility.
Thanks. So my question's about the Vivaldão, and I was really excited to read about it with Bocas Ciudad Deportiva in mind. And one of the parts I got really excited at was the fundraising. So you talk about public lottery, raising a third of the cash. They sold seating in advance, and they had some advertising deals. One of the parallels with my project is that they also had these lotteries. There was approval that was needed from public officials to run them, but they were run privately, actually contracted out to a Brazilian firm. So I was really interested because Independiente in San Lorenzo, also when they build their stadiums and complexes, contract Brazilian firms to run the lotteries, which are cash prizes, but also things like apartments and Bocas, President Armando, put some of his own cars from his Ford car dealership into the lottery. So they were kind of cloaked in a private endeavor. And so therefore it was celebratory, all the support that they got. There might have been public debate around city allocating space or something like that, but the lottery itself wasn't debated in anything that I've run across. But here you have an example of people being, you know, I'm assuming upset if there's some controversy over public funds or public approval over a public lottery being used to build Vivaldao. Is that the case? And could you give us a little color of what you found in your sources about around that public debate?
Sure. And yeah, it's great to hear that connection there. So the lottery and the lotteries ran hand in hand with soft drink sales tax that was also very lucrative. Mm. And from what I can gather from the state government documents, they achieved their aims. They successfully raised the funds. I think regarding the public debate, it was a question about whether the Vivaldao would negatively impact on the existing stadia in the city. And of course, the answer was yes, in some ways. It's no coincidence that the Parque Amazonense goes out of business in 1973. It's no longer the site of key derby matches or key games between teams in Amazonas and Pará. So I think the debate more focused on what the legacy of the Vivaldao would be on a more sustained basis, rather than concerns about the lottery itself. Hmm. And regarding the allocation of space, the stadium was constructed on what at the time really was, we could call maybe an urban frontier. Hmm. There are photos, actually, which I wish I'd included, which have the stadium, the bowl of the stadium, carved out of what looks like typical images of the Amazon being deforested, for instance, to put it dramatically. And it was precisely in the kind of area, the stadium, where there were growing communities, self-generating communities, building homes on this urban frontier. So the stadium was quite a striking development because it prompted the construction to a greater or lesser degree of a road towards it. And, you know, in some ways, something that I'm going to look more at is in what ways did it facilitate as future growth in that part of the urban frontier of the city. But yeah, the lottery itself very much celebrated in most press outlets as something that generated public approval. Though I'm sure there's more to be done on that.
David Kilpatrick has a question.
Yeah, I thank you, Chris. Very, very fascinating paper. I have three rather disconnected questions. So the first one, I suppose, would be predictably from me about the cosmos and the scoreless draw in 1980. From images I've seen, the Colossus was packed to the gills. I don't know if that's accurate. How many were actually at that game? I don't have the numbers to that. So I'm curious what reports you may have read about that match. And if it was a scoreless draw, was it a bit of a dud in terms of spectacle, or was it still a good match, and how well were the Cosmos received there? My second question is just about the big kickabout. Belos talks about this tournament in Manaus being the largest tournament in the world, but that it's bizarrely paired with a beauty pageant. So I'm wondering if soccer is seen as this kind of force of modernization. Has there been anything, any change in that setup of the tournament? And how does that relate to the more hegemonic forces of soccer in Manaus, or is that where power lies with that tournament? And the third is, you touched on Levi Strauss a little bit, and just thinking about that beautiful stadium, but I'm curious how locals received the aesthetics of the stadium itself. I know it's been talked about so much in terms of the wet elephant. You mentioned earlier the idea of it looking almost like the Amazon being carved out, but I'm just wondering how locals received the aesthetics of the stadium. So apologies for three disconnected questions, but if you'll answer any one of those three, I'd be grateful. Thanks.
Thanks very much, David. I really appreciate those questions. So first on the Cosmos visit in 1980, yes, it's the record attendance that's recorded in the most authoritative accounts of the history of the Colossus. So it's 56,000, I think, is the number, though that's off the top of my head, so I'd have to check that, which is an astonishing number, and it speaks really, I think, to the need to have a certain skepticism about these numbers, because the nominal capacity is down in the early 40,000s. But the game itself generated huge interest,
yes,
as evidenced by the attendance. And actually, it being a 0-0 draw
49.
Was in keeping with a pattern of disappointing on-field performances by visiting stars. So when Pelé first played in Manaus with his club team in 1968, Santos, he was jeered for much of the first half, and he eventually did score, so he got a cheer then, and it turned it around. But Garrincha's visit, sorry to use yet another binary of Pelé and Garrincha, but when Garrincha visited the following year, he only lasted 30 minutes or so, and it was considered to be something of a dud. So in sporting terms, there is a pattern of disappointing performances. When Brazil played a few friendlies, three friendlies and then one World Cup qualifying match in the 1990s and early 2000s, similarly, expectations were extremely high, and the on-field performance in games such as a 1-0 victory over Ecuador generated disappointment. I'm still not quite sure how to engage with that in my work, the question of expectations, disappointments, and what it actually means, the relative importance of what goes on the field and what happens off it. But I'm glad you brought that up. Thanks. To the big kick about the Peladão, the beauty pageant aspect to it, which Alex Belos, I think, brilliantly captured. There's also a German language documentary, I believe from 2007, which focused on the Peladão for foreign language speakers. And yes, until 2007, there were only male competitors on the field. But in recent years, a female competition has developed, and it now hosts its final during the same set of finals as the men's final and the veterans final. The beauty pageant aspect continues. I attended the opening ceremony and the final last year. The queens, so for anyone who's not familiar, every team in the Big Kickabout puts forward a female beauty pageant contestant. And even if the male team is eliminated on the field from the tournament, if the beauty queen gets through her round, the team are allowed back into the tournament or given another shot. And then really it's gone commercial to a remarkable degree, in that the 12 victorious beauty queens spend 40 days or so on a boat on the river in a reality show. And that's how it culminates on that side. But perhaps more interestingly for us, the on-field situation has changed significantly. Not only is there a female soccer tournament as part of the Big Kickabout, but also the preeminent female team this year in Manaus, Iranduba, are currently involved in the female national championship. And they played Flamengo. They lost yesterday. But they got a draw against them last week. And one of the things I'd be interested to explore more is the question of, similar to in the international women's soccer field, when many countries are starting somehow, in terms of getting support from governments and football administrations, they're starting from scratch. You know, there's always been that tradition there, but they're starting from scratch in some ways. The gender coefficient, global gender coefficient, matches much more neatly with the performance of teams than it does in the male game. If you see, I'm not sure I explained that fully, but hopefully you'll see what I mean. And I'm wondering whether the growth of women's soccer in Brazil is something that will facilitate a more equal distribution of teams around the country rather than focused on the existing clubs. That's simply something on the side. And thirdly, yeah, the question of the stadium. So in 1970, as I said to Alex, the stadium was built in a what could be described as a sort of green location. By 2009, 2010, when the old stadium starts to be demolished and you build the World Cup stadium, it's already ensconced in Manaus's urban space. And the design is something that, yes, engaged much discussion. The modeled in some ways on the Chinese Beijing Olympics birdcage, but also to designed to represent indigenous woven basket. I think there's more to be done on, you know, what the meaning of the reaction is. But to segue into what the reaction in Manaus was to the World Cup, well, there was lots of local boosterism about the fact that Manaus received high grades in the surveys of international and national tourists when compared with other host cities. So the ongoing discussion in Manaus's press about the failures to use the arena more regularly and profitably are counterposed to some degree by a perceived success in the most narrow of terms for visitors. And I think that's something I'd like to investigate more with the assistance of Brazilian colleagues who are working on this and other related topics.
Do you have anything?
Thank you.
82nd minute. Anyone else have any parting questions? We have a couple in reserve here, but give anyone a chance who hasn't asked a second question. Okay, Peter has another one for you, Chris.
Well, since we've talked about the stadiums quite a bit and public opinion, I wanted to circle back to South Africa's experience with World Cup stadiums, five brand new ones, five others of which several were refurbished, one almost entirely, where the final was played at Soccer City. South Africans' views of those stadiums have changed over the past few years. There was tremendous pride in those so-called world-class venues, particularly in places like Durban, you know, and even Cape Town, where, you know, people, I stood next to folks who were just, you know, their jaws dropped when they saw the facility for the first time and when they walked in there and just took it all in and saw it as a tremendous accomplishment for a young democracy like South Africa to build these unbelievably beautiful and expensive stadiums and that welcome the world. A few years later, not everybody feels that way, not that everybody did back then, but there seems to be more criticism. Even the head of the South African Organizing Committee, you know, essentially apologized for spending so much money on these often beautiful arenas. Have the people in Manaus responded in similar ways? I mean, it's only been a couple of years since the World Cup, not even, but has that euphoria of the moment given way, or the Olympics around the corner and therefore maybe they're still excited about it, or what is the public opinion towards the Arena Amazonia?
And does it have anything to do with current political developments in Brazil?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Great question. I would start by saying I don't think there ever was truly a sense of euphoria to any great degree. And I think a lot of that had to do with the observation of the South Africa World Cup. I think comparisons were made. They certainly were made in the press, and politicians would comment on the upcoming plans of the stadium, the city, by emphasizing that they were conscious of the risk of having a white elephant. So I think the starting point, the bar was lower just from the get-go in Manaus. And I think when the major newspapers published 1 year on anniversary editions remembering the World Cup, they laid it out plain that the majority of the urban infrastructure projects promised. So one prominent example, there was talk of a monorail to alleviate Manaus's really quite difficult transport infrastructure problem. They had been all left to one side. And what was left was, yes, a slightly improved airport, but also the stadium. And the predictability of the lack of regular well-attended matches at the stadium has surprised no one, but has only decreased any excitement that was there. So I think starting from a lower... I'm not familiar with exactly what levels of euphoria we're talking about, but I think it was from a much lower starting point in Brazil, partly as a response to South Africa experience. And I'd like to add, though, that because of the history of Manaus, there is on the one hand a resignation in the city about the likelihood of at some point being cut adrift, and the stadium could be seen as it's a literal, but also it's a metaphor of that. You know, if teams from Rio and Sao Paulo stop coming to play exhibition matches in the stadium, then that really could be curtains. But as well as this anxiety about Manaus's apparent isolation and very real isolation, there's also this recognition that Manaus is special somehow in the minds of national level policymakers, and certainly in the minds of international observers and participants. Now, most crudely, this is manifested through the continuation of the free trade zone and industrial pole. It's a topic of election debates always. How successfully will certain candidates defend the special economic conditions of Manaus's free trade zone? And also, crudely, we could say that multinational investors are attractive to Manaus through this. But I would also say there is some residual confidence in Manaus that there's no reason why a local club couldn't be taken to the next level and more regularly play in the national championship at the first or second division. And so I think this is the primary point of discussion at the city level. You know, Manaus is seen as special from the outside, and yet people in the city are aware that in some ways the creation of this special economic zone leaves Manaus ever more vulnerable to future changes at the national level. So, I mean, I just had just a slight hint of optimism, or at least optimism about there being the potential for this not to be a white elephant. Of course, it seems unlikely that fate will be avoided.
Great. Well, we'll finish there. Thanks again, Chris, for sharing this paper and sharing your time. And thanks everyone else who joined in on the conversation to engage with this exciting work on Manaus.
Thanks so much, everyone.